The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Well, welcome to the best panel in this conference. No, I'm really privileged to welcome all of you here, and especially our distinguished panelists. I have to say that I'm privileged to call all of the panelists friends, and I'm very happy that they made the trek here. I would like to introduce in the order in which they're going to make their presentations, and hopefully we will have some time for discussions. In your program, there was also listed Chantal, Professor Chantal Thomas from University of Minnesota. She unfortunately is unable to join us. We received an email from her last night saying that Egypt Air overbooked her. She was in Cairo. They managed to find her a seat, but then the U.S. government doesn't allow people to be switched over and come to America last minute, from Egypt at least. So she just can't make it in time for this conference, and so she apologizes for that. And I'm very sad about that because I think she would have added to our discussion today. Be it as it may, I would like to start to introduce our first speaker is Anna Sophie Herkin, who is an alumni of the school, and I had the privilege of knowing her when she was a student here, and she was one of the first, I think, research assistants I ever had. She and nobody's ever been able to fill up her shoes ever since. She is the Assistant Executive Secretary of the World Bank Inspection Panel in Washington, D.C. The inspection panel, if any of you don't know, at the World Bank is an independent accountability mechanism for people who believe that they have been or are likely to be harmed by a World Bank-funded project. Anna has a strong background in trade policy issues. Before she joined the World Bank, she held several positions in the German Federal Ministry of Economics, where she lastly served as deputy head of the International Trade Policy Division, dealing with services, sustainable trade, and intellectual property. During her work at the ministry, she participated at the WTO Ministerial in Cancun, the G8 World Economic Summit, Johannesburg World Summit of Sustainable Development, amongst others. She served as a German representative to the so-called 133 Trade Committee in Brussels, where EU member states meet weekly to define and negotiate the EU trade position. She also represented Germany in other fora, including UNCTAD, United Nations Center for Trade and Development, OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, and the UN. Prior to joining the German government, she was a trainee in the Trade and Environment Division of the WTO. Next to her is somebody who anybody in WTO trade circles knows of, is Deborah Steger. Deborah Steger is currently a professor at the University of Ottawa Faculty of Law, where she teaches in the field of international trade, globalization, international trade dispute settlement, and governance of international institutions. She is the founder and director of the EDGE Network on the Emerging Dynamic Global Economies, a multidisciplinary network comprised of leading researchers in international business, economics, law, and public policy. Previously, she served as the first director of the Appellate Body Secretariat of the WTO in Geneva. She is responsible for figuring out all the kinks, setting out all the rules, all the procedures, all the hoopla around amicus curiae briefs, everything that you can figure out Deborah has addressed or dealt with. Prior to that, she was a senior negotiator for Canada during the Uruguay round on dispute settlement and establishment of the WTO. She was a principal counsel to the government of Canada for all of the Uruguay round agreements from 1991 to 1995. She was general counsel of the Canadian International Trade Tribunal in Ottawa, that the agency is responsible for administering anti-dumping, countervail safeguards, and government procurement legislation in Canada. Last but not least, we have Dr. Andrew Lang, that I had the privilege of meeting not too long ago, actually in November, when we were both at a conference at Bretton Woods. Andrew is an amazing scholar, and he lectures in international economic law and public international law at the London School of Economics, LSE. He completed his doctoral studies at the University of Cambridge, UK, and in 2003 worked for a period at the World Commission on the Social Dimension of Globalization. He is currently working on a forthcoming monograph on human rights and the international trade regime. It's my privilege to have him here, and I'm very glad he made the trek over from London to join us on these 2 days. When the thinking came to me about how to, and Danny came and said, we need to organize a couple of trade panels for the 25th anniversary of the LSP, I knew that one issue that we needed to address was the effect that the WTO rules have on the vision of maybe the rule of law internally within member states. I had written a few years back in 2004 a book chapter in honor of Sylvia Ostry, who used to be a trade negotiator for Canada, on the use of transparency, and especially Article 10 of GATT. Those of you that may be familiar with this, there is a provision in the GATT that dates back to its beginning in 1947 that says that basically trade regulations should be administered in a fair, equitable, and reasonable manner. And even though the word transparency is not specifically mentioned there, it is very much the trust of it. Now, when we look at it historically, it was drafted around the same time as the Administrative Procedure Act of the United States was passed, exactly that same year, and some of their language very much parallels it. Since 1947, we have seen the rise of the regulatory state, and so when we talk about free trade, we talk about it within the context of a very complicated regulatory administrative state. And throughout the WTO agreements that were signed in 1994, that came into effect in 1995, there are a lot of agreements where there is a lot of emphasis on process. You see it in the import licensing agreement, you see it in the TPT agreement, you see it in anti-dumping, you see it throughout. It's a lot of it is a particular vision of allowing people to participate, notice, due process, and it has a particular, as I came to think about it, a particular vision of the law. And for those of us who have sort of been involved in this anti-corruption sort of crusade, one would say, or initiatives that are going worldwide, it struck me that maybe the initiatives that were being done indirectly through the WTO may actually do more to promote that kind of transparency than any kind of international anti-corruption agreement that we can have signed, whether it's in the OECD or the UN or the OAS. But I wasn't very sure how this is all proceeding when we sort of realized that there was a lot of scholarship being done on whether or not there is such a thing as a global administrative law, whether there's an emergence of this sort of discipline or not. And with people like Benedict Kingsbury at NYU that started this project, and Chantel was actually going to talk about whether or not we have such a thing as global administrative law. But so that is really the background for the title, which was the impact of international trade law on domestic administration. That word was picked purposefully, administration of laws, as opposed to just, obviously, it requires a lot of substantive changes in the laws of various member states. So without further ado, I would like to introduce Anna Harkin. Thank you. I'm going to turn the lights down, if I can. We go down? Yeah. Can you see?
Yeah, it's okay. Okay, thanks a lot, Padilla, for inviting me, and it's extremely nice to be here, because the first time I actually heard about trade law was in Padilla's, I think, first class that you taught on trade law, so it's quite nice to build on that. I thought for today I'll speak about a very specific issue, which is the domestic regulation in the context of the General Agreement on Trade and Services. And that's something that might sound very technical, but there's actually a very interesting question behind that. It relates to the question whether the GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Services, intrudes too far into the regulatory space of member states. And many of you might have followed in the big newspapers over the past years there's been quite a lot of debate and criticism about the GATS, and NGO, civil society or interest groups have come up and said, oh, what happens with the GATS? Does it force member states to privatize? Does it take away your regulatory space? Can you really come up and regulate services the way you want? Or GATS, what does GATS do to you? And there's been so much fear and so many concerns about it that I thought it would be really interesting to discuss that. But I do not intend to give you a conclusion at that point, or not even later, because I want to end with the same question that I raise now, because it's a really complex issue. Instead, I think it would be quite nice to talk a little bit about how the GATS is structured and what is negotiated at the moment. So perhaps you can come up with your own conclusion, or we can discuss it. So what's quite interesting is to see that there has been, again, so many fears expressed with regard to GATS. And the question is, why is that? And it might certainly be explained by the fact that the GATS is a quite young agreement, and also that trade and services is increasing. But more importantly, and I'm going to simplify that now, trade and services is something which is very difficult to visualize. If you look at goods, you have goods being traded from country A to country B, let's say school books, and you might have some limitations on the borders. But what happens if you talk about educational services? If you have foreigners coming to your country, opening up schools or sending teachers, that touches much more on the core values of a nation. And this is why this issue has come up so much and there's so much fear about it. So again, I think it's quite helpful to actually look at the GATS, because the GATS is, I would say, a rather complex agreement. And I think a lot of the fears can perhaps be taken away by understanding how it works. And the GATS actually tried to strike a balance between creating a fair and equitable trade rules and trying to get reliability through commitments, but on the other hand, by trying to pay due respect to national policy objectives. And quite importantly, the preamble of the GATS explicitly recognizes the right of members to regulate and to introduce new regulation to meet their national policy objectives. One of the other reasons why I think there has been so much discussion about the GATS is that the GATS has a very wide scope of application. So it applies to any measure which can affect trade and services. And the term measure is defined in the agreement, and it's very broad. That means it can include any form of regulation, or it can include regulations or administrative decisions. It can be taken by any form of governmental body, local bodies, central bodies, and even non-governmental bodies when they have delegated powers. And the GATS also has acknowledged that services can be provided in very many different ways. So unlike trading goods, services can, whatever, like you can have cross-border supply. You know, if you can do advice via internet. You can also have a foreign commercial establishment, which is an FDI-like provision. So you have foreign companies coming into your country, opening up hospitals or doing investment. And you can also have just natural persons, the foreign cab driver, the foreign doctor coming to your country. So that, again, is also a very wide sphere of application. And the GATS also applies to all kind of services. There's just one minor exception, which are certain air traffic rights. And there's one very important exception, which is that the GATS does not apply to services that are supplied in the exercise of governmental authority. And again, that's also more specifically defined in the agreement itself. So this is meant to cover services that are supplied neither on a commercial basis nor in competition with other service suppliers. So if you look at the very wide field of application, you can understand why there are so many insecurities. On the other hand, and that's, I think, a very important point, the GATS has a very unique and flexible structure with regard to the obligations that you actually take as a member state. So it's very different to the GATT agreement. So in the GATS, you start what you call with a bottom-up approach. It's like a negative-positive approach. So the GATS does not force any member state to open up specific sectors for competition. So if you decide that you do not want to open up most of the sectors, that's fine. So it's possible that one country takes very little commitments and the other one takes a lot of commitments. And that's, again, that's something that's totally fine under the GATS. There's no obligation that everybody does the same, opens up the same. And another very positive thing, I think, is that if you decide to open up a service sector to competition, you can do that in a very tailored way. So you have more than 160 subsectors under the GATS. So you do not have to say, I do not want to have all doctors coming into my country. I just want doctors for internal medicine. And if you do not want to have hospitals coming in, but only whatever, natural persons, that's fine. So it means you cannot only cherry-pick certain sectors, but you can also within a sector say, I do not want to have all modes of supply. I only want the natural person coming. I do not want the company coming in. And even if you decide to what we call schedule a commitment, which means that you sort of sign an obligation to open up your market to competition, you can always put in limitations and restrictions. So the GATS itself does not include all these commitments. You would normally have tons of paper with schedules, and they're organized by sector and by mode of supply, and you would say where you're open and where not, and you could always put in a limitation. So talking about hospital services, you could say, okay, I want to open up my market, but I would like to have a quota. I only want to have 20% of my hospitals run by foreigners. You can also say that you can put in some that's very relevant in the context of financial services. You can put some limitation on certain joint venture conditions. And so again, you just have to schedule it. You have to put it in writing into your schedules. So you can decide to open up in a very tailored way. You don't have to have a black and white approach. You just say, okay, I do a gray zone. I open up a little bit, and that's fine. And even at one point, if you see that you perhaps face a very new situation where you might have to breach your own commitment, you might always have the chance to justify it under one of the GATS exceptions. So overall, the member states maintain the right to regulate. So if I allow the hospital to establish itself to supply services, I can always maintain the right to apply my domestic laws if I have certain qualifications that the hospital has to fulfill. That's fine. If I have certain requirements on the education of doctors, that's fine too. So the question is, what happens, or should there be any disciplines that regulate or talk about under which conditions domestic regulations should be brought, or should there be any limitations on that? And the GATS itself does not talk about that. The GATS has in its text itself, it has a provision which calls upon the member states to come up and agree whether they want to have disciplines on domestic regulation or whether and how they should look like. So again, as I said, the GATS does not make any judgment on domestic regulation. But the question comes up, so what if domestic regulation or intransparencies actually lead to a situation where the commitments are nullified? And how do we sort of balance that with the respect that we have to pay for the members' rights to regulate? How do we strike that balance? And again, this is why probably the GATS has left this open to the member states to negotiate it. And according to Article 6, 4 GATS, the Council on Trade and Services has been called upon to develop new disciplines. With the objective to ensure that non-discriminatory measures that relate to qualification requirements, to procedures, technical standards, licensing requirements, do not constitute unnecessary barriers to trade. The question is, what are unnecessary barriers to trade, and what are we actually going to negotiate here, and what are we going to define and put under these disciplines? Article 6 itself does not contain much text on that. All it says is that the discipline should aim at ensuring that the requirements that member states impose on the supply of services should be based on objective and transparent criteria, should be not more burdensome than necessary, and in the case of licensing procedures, should not be a restriction on the supply of a service itself. So the member states for the past years have been negotiating about this, and there has not been much agreement reached so far. Moreover, the negotiations show how far away the member states are in their perception of what should be in these disciplines. And so far, it has shown that there are some major big issues that have come up and that the member states have to decide about. And one, for example, is if you come up with disciplines on domestic regulation, should they apply only where a member state has entered a commitment, has decided to open up its service market? Or should they apply to all services sector, even if you've decided not to open up a sector because you think it's a very sensitive sector? There seems to be a majority or sort of agreement that most country member states do not want to apply this unless you really have scheduled a commitment, unless you've agreed to open up your service sector. But the second question related to that is, if you come up with disciplines, should you try to develop disciplines for each sector, which are much more specific? Or would you just do a big, broad approach? So you would draft disciplines that apply what we call horizontally, which do not go so much in depth. And the developing countries are very concerned that if you would do it on a sectoral basis, the big countries, US and the European Commission, you would just cherry-pick the important sectors for us and draft the disciplines, but would leave out the sectors that are very important to the developing countries. One of the big questions also, define what is not more burdensome than necessary. That has raised the issue, how to define necessary? What should be the test here? And some countries have suggested that necessary could mean it should be the least trade restrictive measure that you apply. But again, many countries have said, no, this should not be up to the WTO. We should not discuss it within the WTO. We do not need a necessity test because that could interfere too much with the regulatory space of members. The European Commission, for example, has come up with a proposal regarding proportionality. That's a concept we use a lot in Europe, which means that you would never question whether the objective is legitimate, but you would see if there's any other measure which is not as trade restrictive and which is as efficient. But again, there's a variety of views and there has been no agreement reached so far. Another big issue that's discussed are transparency requirements. And the US, for example, would like to include a prior common procedure, which means that whenever you sort of issue a new regulation, other member states should have the right to comment on that. And that's something where the developing countries say, oh, listen, this is too much. We would never be able to implement that. That's too costly. So again, that's something which is very unlikely to be in the disciplines, but it's something which is discussed. And another very important question is, or the European Commission has raised that a lot, is it actually easy to, or could there be perhaps problems to clearly differentiate between what is a market access, what affects market access, what is only domestic regulation? Shouldn't we come up with more specified definitions? Because that's a quite important, if you limit what you define as a market access restriction, you have much broader space for domestic regulation. But again, there's not been much discussion about it so far. So it's at the moment, there's the past year, there's not been much progress in the negotiating groups. But again, this is quite important to follow because depending on what member states will agree within these disciplines, you will see how much the GATS can actually intrude, if I call it negatively, intrude into the regulatory space. So I will end this with the same question that I raised in the beginning, because I think there is no clear answer to that, and I think we can perhaps discuss that later. Thank you.
Thank you. Turn the light on. Deborah, you can do it sitting down or standing up, whichever one you prefer. Okay. And then we'll have questions and discussion. So remember her question.
Oops, I better not trip. Okay. it's a tremendous pleasure for me to be here today, and I want to thank Padide, Professor Alai, for inviting me once again to your esteemed university, which is a sister university. We have programs in common with my law school at the University of Ottawa, so it's great to be able to come down. I'm also thrilled to be here because it snowed this week in Canada, and there's still snow and ice on the ground, and today it's 70-something or 80 degrees, and there are flowers blooming, and I have to get used to running around without a coat and boots and all those things and gloves, and, you know, so any invitation this time of year is more than welcome. I'll be down here in a flash. I'm going to talk about China and a long road, long march to the rule of law. I'm not going to talk about Canada, surprisingly enough. I wrote a lengthy article about Canada's implementation of the Uruguay Round Agreements, which appeared in a book edited by John Jackson and Alan Sykes and someone else, maybe Bill Davey, back in 95 or something. So you can look at that if you want to know about Canada. I wrote a very lengthy piece that explained all about the Canadian Constitution and how we implement international trade agreements, in particular the WTO agreement and the NAFTA. But I'm going to focus today on China because, frankly, what's happening in China is far more important to the world than anything that's going on in Canada. And furthermore, as Professor Alai mentioned, one of my sort of major preoccupations today or these days is a new multidisciplinary research network that I am building on the emerging economies, both within Canada and also internationally. A great Canadian lady and scholar, Sylvia Austrey, edited a book that Professor Alai contributed to and referred to in her opening comments, entitled China, the Long March to the WTO. And of course, Professor Austrey, Dr. Austrey, has written about China and the transparency issue back in 1999, before China's accession. And at that time, Sylvia said there was a considerable mismatch between the WTO's transparency requirements and the Chinese legal regime, and that a fundamental reason for this mismatch, she said, is embedded in Chinese historical and cultural traditions. Although she conceded in that article that political cultures do change, she warned, and she took sort of maybe a sort of cynical view at the time, that without some major new initiative to facilitate change in China's administrative law regime, China's accession to the WTO, she warned, will create serious problems both for China and for the WTO. Well, was Dr. Austrey correct? You know, I think China is extremely important because we haven't seen anything like the massive transformation taking place in China since, I don't think, since the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century. I mean, we weren't all there, but we all know about it from the history books. I think this is really the second major economic transformation taking place. In 2003, which wasn't that long ago, China represented 10% of world trade. In 2010, she will represent 50% of world trade. Over 60% of foreign direct investment flows from OECD countries to non-OECD countries flows to China. The challenge is not only how much China will integrate into the world economic system, but how much the world will integrate into China. A recent edition of The Economist magazine, just about every second or third one is about China, and the other ones are about India, noted the tremendous impact decisions made in China, things going on in China, have on financial markets in the United States and Europe and on our own domestic systems and certainly our own domestic economies. China's accession to the WTO in 2001 was a major event both for China and for the multilateral trading system. It signaled a new China that wanted to open its doors to the world and become part of the world. And, you know, in many ways, China is unique among many developing countries in that it is building its development strategy around its accession to the WTO. So the WTO accession is driving a lot of the change taking place in China. And this isn't something that, you know, other countries have imposed on China. This is something that China wanted to do, certainly that the central government wanted to do. No one can doubt China's incredible determination, good faith, and the tremendous progress it has made so far in reforming its laws and institutions. Through its membership in the WTO, China has embarked on a major transformation of its economic structure, but this pales in comparison to the massive reform it is undertaking in developing a whole new kind of administrative structure, a new legal system, and really a regulatory state. This challenge is particularly profound. We can't imagine the kind of change taking place in China because it strikes at the very heart of social and cultural values, history, traditions, perceptions, and behavior. So what impact have the transparency obligations of the WTO in particular had? I'm not going to talk at great length about Article 10 of the GATT. Professor Alai has mentioned it, except to note that it's true. Article 10 of the GATT was based on American State Department proposals. But, you know, of the 23 original contracting parties of the GATT, most of them didn't view Article 10 at the time as requiring them really to do anything. I mean, Canada said it could live with it no problem because that article imposed no obligations on Canada that it was not already complying with. And basically, Article 10 is just about publication and uniform administration, whatever that means. But I looked at most of the recent cases in the WTO that are primarily about anti-dumping, and they haven't been interpreting uniform administration as meaning anything lately. And they always defer to language in the anti-dumping or other specific agreements anyway. So not a major obligation, but the Chinese, you know, probably wish they could say the same that Canada said back in 1947 about the transparency obligations they were required to agree to, i.e., you know, no problem, we're already complying with them, because China certainly couldn't say that. In addition to the transparency obligations contained in the WTO agreement, not only in Article 10, but the more important, more detailed ones now are in the TBT agreement, the SPS agreement, the subsidies and countervailing measures agreement, the anti-dumping agreement, the GATS, the trade-related intellectual property rights agreement, the TRIPS. All of those agreements have more extensive obligations than Article 10 of the GATT itself. So China took on, you know, as part of its single undertaking, not only all of those obligations, but on top of that, China has WTO plus transparency obligations in its protocol of accession. And those obligations, you know, apply to China on top of the regular WTO obligations on transparency. In its protocol, the special obligations that are specific to China that it has taken on include publication of proposals for new laws and regulations with a right of comment, so the kind of U.S. version of notice and comment. I might tell you just parenthetically, again, sorry to be referring back and forth to Canada, Canada couldn't live up to that obligation, okay? There's no way. We do not have a general notice and comment requirement for all new proposed laws, regulations, and government measures across the board. So, and I'm sure that's probably true of a lot of other developed countries, with the exception of the United States. Enforcement only of those laws and regulations that are published, translation into the three official languages of the WTO of all Chinese laws and regulations and government measures affecting trade, services, TRIPS, and foreign exchange controls. Well, very interesting, because the WTO agreement doesn't even regulate foreign exchange controls, but China now has obligations pertaining to them. inquiry points for WTO members to seek information about laws, regulations, and government practices. Now, those kinds of provisions are in some of the WTO agreements, but basically, that was a major new requirement for China. And I think the most difficult one of all, prompt review of all administrative actions by independent judicial institutions. Now, once again, if you look carefully at the transparency obligations in most of the WTO agreements, they do not all require, very strong obligations on the part of a country's judicial institutions. But here we have across the board for China relating to all measures affecting or even pertaining generally to trade in goods, trade in services, trade-related intellectual property, and foreign exchange control, a requirement that they must have not only prompt review of all administrative actions, but it has to be done by independent judicial institutions. A transitional review mechanism was also established at the sort of insistence of the U.S. and EC in their side agreements with China to monitor China's compliance. Well, what's the report card? You know, we're in a law school. It's getting close to that time of the year. It was one thing for China to agree to open up its economy to foreign exports and investment. Quite another is the massive challenge it faces in reforming its administrative rulemaking and judicial regimes. Accession to the WTO is bringing with it far more than integrating China into the world economy. It's also accelerating a really massive transformation of China's internal domestic governance regime to create functioning administrative and judicial regimes. Thus, the WTO is responsible not only for opening up China's economy to the world, and the world's economy to China, I guess, but it is also encouraging China to develop very rapidly a legal system. And that is, in itself is really a major achievement. Changing the rules is relatively simple in comparison with changing a legal culture and deeply ingrained behaviors and traditions based on a very long history. Well, first of all, how's China doing on some of these requirements in its protocol? Well, on reform of its laws, China is implementing its WTO obligations largely by transformation. There's sort of a debate among scholars about whether some WTO obligations might be directly effective in China under the Chinese legal system. But in terms of the way the government's going about it, it's implementing its obligations largely by transformation, by enacting new laws and regulations, by reviewing and amending existing inconsistent laws and regulations. On this particular front, China has made really incredibly massive strides. It has promulgated thousands of new laws and regulations. I read several articles that were published 2003, 2004. They were talking about 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 or 6,000 at that point. It's probably 10,000. I don't know how many thousands of laws and regulations have been reviewed, revised, new ones have been enacted. And this is just the central government alone. As everyone knows, the real challenges and problems, potential problems with WTO inconsistencies, is not likely to be found so much in federal regulation, but rather the local governments and authorities. China has also, just in the past few years, signed over 200 new bilateral trade agreements, over 70 bilateral investment treaties, many of which, interestingly enough, for those of you who are private lawyers out there, provide for private rights of action for foreign companies, and almost 100 tax treaties just in the last sort of handful of years. It's relatively easy, most commentators would probably say immediately, to promulgate new laws and regulations, to turn out a lot of paper and to sign new treaties, especially in a country that's run by a central state bureaucracy. The challenge lies in enforcing those laws and in ensuring that the local authorities in a country as vast and populated and decentralized as China, understand and comply with WTO obligations. For foreigners, moreover, identifying possible WTO inconsistencies is not easy, and that's why China's transparency requirements are so important to the rest of the world, and particularly to foreign enterprises wanting to do business in China or to invest in China. There are two major challenges that I think China faces with implementation of its WTO transparency obligations. The first is that local protectionism is rampant. Local governments are unable or unwilling to stop engaging in inconsistent practices, and the central government either cannot or will not control these inconsistent acts of the local governments. And the second major problem, I'll talk more about that in a few minutes, is the capacity of the court system to play a serious role in the enforcement of WTO consistent laws and regulations. China's courts are weak as an institution. Its judges are widely recognized as poorly qualified, and they lack independence, and there are some other systemic problems in the court system that I'll talk about in a minute. Now, how are they doing on the notice and comment provisions for new amendments or new proposed laws? Again, this is a very broad commitment that China has made. For the first time in its history, China has begun to publish regulations and laws for public comment before their implementation. Although this obligation is not carried out by all government agencies and authorities, particularly those at the local level, MOFCOM, the Ministry of Commerce, and some of the federal ministries are doing this now. There's really been a remarkable sea change just in the last year or so. And in many cases, after receiving comments from foreign companies and governments, laws or regulations are actually modified before they are promulgated. In 2006, the National People's Congress solicited comments before passing the labor contract law and a brand new anti-monopoly law. Also that year, the State Intellectual Property Office solicited comments on draft revisions to China's patent law, and there are other ministries as well, Ministry of Commerce and Securities Regulatory Commission, that sought comments on revisions to important regulations that really affect the way business is done in China. And they not only asked for and received comments from foreign businesses, that in many cases they took them into account and actually revised their legislation and their regulations. Again, a lot more than, you know, some developed countries do. Canada doesn't have a process like that and certainly doesn't feel any obligation to even seek notice comments from Canadian stakeholders, never mind foreign stakeholders. So these are obviously critical and important steps. The central government is clearly setting a good example for local and regional authorities. However, because much regulation is local in China, there's still a long way to go to ensure compliance by local and regional authorities of this particular requirement. So, what about publication of laws and enforcement only of published laws? Once again, in this area, China's central government has taken great strides, but there remains a lot to be done at the local level. With enforcement of laws generally in China, there are major problems, and that's largely as a result of a weak and ineffective judicial system. Since 2003, China's central ministries and agencies have a much improved record of publishing and making available to the public new or revised laws and regulations in Chinese. At the same time, China lags behind in providing translations of those measures. In April 2006, the State Council issued a decree requiring all government bodies to report in any regulations affecting trade to the Ministry of Commerce for publication in its official gazette. While we might think that, you know, establishing an official gazette is not a big thing. For China, this is a huge thing. This is something that I know the U.S.-China Business Council in particular had been saying for years. They wanted sort of one official publication where you could find all laws, decrees, regulations, measures, etc. in China. Well, China has now established that journal, and you know it's moving forward. Before, companies had to sort of look on various websites and all kinds of different sources to try to find the source of laws and regulations. So that's a major step. Inquiry points. Well, China promised to designate one or more inquiry points where information about all laws, regulations, and other measures affecting trade could be reviewed. In addition, any individual, company, or WTO member can request information about any measure required to be published under China's accession protocol at that inquiry point, and China is required to answer within 30 to 45 days. Again, pretty incredible obligations. Well, China has established a main inquiry point in MOFCOM, the Ministry of Commerce. Canada, through the Canadian International Development Agency, CETA, has a major multi-year project in which it is working to assist China, particularly in this area, in establishing its inquiry points and training its officials in helping it to live up to its transparency obligations. China has taken major steps in the right direction, but given the vastness of the regulatory regime in China, it will take some time before other WTO members and foreign enterprises are able to obtain all of the information that they need to really understand all of the laws and regulations, et cetera. Again, once again, particularly at the local level that apply to business in China. Translation of laws and regulations. Well, the commitment to make available not less than 90 days after implementation. Wow. All laws, regulations, or other measures affecting trade and goods, services, TRIPS, or foreign exchange control in one or more of the three official languages of the WTO was a very ambitious commitment on the part of China. And it is a commitment that is obviously of great interest to foreign companies and other WTO members, but it's not surprising that the, you know, tens of thousands of new and revised laws and regulations that China has promulgated in the past few years in an effort to implement its WTO obligations on the substantive side, most of these laws have not yet been translated into one of the official languages of the WTO. Okay. Prompt review by independent judicial institutions. Well, reform of the courts is really the most important area, I think, that is critical to establishing a functioning legal system in China. There are significant concerns with the qualifications of judges, the willingness and capacity of the courts to render fair and independent judgments free of corruption and political influence, and the ability of courts to execute and enforce judgments. The task is really massive, but there is a strong domestic constituency for reforming the judicial system. Steps are being taken to improve the quality of judges through extensive training programs, many of which are supported by foreign aid agencies. However, there are major hurdles that emanate from the customary legal culture. It is not easy to change established traditions and ways of thinking. At this time, China's courts are not practically capable of enforcing statutory rights for a number of reasons. The most important relates to the customary legal culture. Courts and government officials will generally consider a ministry or a local government regulation that is specific to be the applicable rule over a different statute passed by the National People's Congress. This is contrary to the hierarchy of laws that's set out in the Chinese Constitution, but nevertheless, that's the way things function in practice. Second, there really is a serious problem of corruption and pressures from local government officials, once again, the local and regional authorities. You know, in the context of the EDGE network, I've asked major multinational companies, what are the main barriers that they face in China? And they don't seem to be concerned about negotiating new trade agreements or negotiating new bilateral investment treaties with China. What they mention, what executives mention to me, business leaders mention to me every time is domestic rule of law, enforceability of contracts and of even existing laws, corruption, corporate social responsibility, in terms of not only corporate governance, but also adherence to environmental standards, adherence to labor standards, and things like that. Those are the things that really matter to business. Third, there's a difficulty in enforcing judgments. Courts are unwilling to do it. Fourth, the courts are reluctant to take jurisdiction sometimes over difficult or sensitive cases. In China, courts can choose to accept or decline jurisdiction, and they will often decline if they feel that the topic is might create problems for the judges later. Finally, under the Chinese Constitution, courts are not empowered to adjudicate questions relating to whether a domestic law is consistent with WTO obligations, or to resolve differences or conflicts between laws and regulations promulgated by different authorities. The higher legislative authority, not the courts, have the power to overrule conflicting laws enacted by a lower legislative authority, and only the National People's Congress Standing Committee has the authority to declare a law null and void because of inconsistency with an international treaty. So this is part of the legal culture, and it will be difficult for China, I think, certainly in the short to medium term, to provide truly independent review of administrative actions. Coupled with the tradition of judicial deference to administration, judges are considered of a lower political status to government officials whose actions they are actually reviewing. Thus, serious reform of the judicial system will be needed before there can be really truly independent review of administrative actions. In its accession protocol, just to sum up now, China agreed to major commitments relating to transparency that are causing, in many ways, a major transformation within China. A transformation not only in its administrative bureaucracies, but also in its rulemaking and judicial systems. A new regulatory state is emerging in China, in part influenced and prodded along by WTO obligations on transparency, independent review of administrative actions. But I think we also have to recognize that there's tremendous internal constituency for change in China as well. The changes taking place in China's administrative and judicial structures are driven to a certain extent, you know, from outside by the WTO and by other WTO members and private enterprises. But more importantly, they're being driven by domestic constituencies within China. As the new regulatory state is beginning to emerge, it is clear that although it will be influenced to a certain extent by outside forces, ultimately the regulatory and judicial systems that emerge will be a made in China systems. They are not going to reflect exactly Western traditions, values, and Western institutions, and nor should they. I, for one, think that we really must have some patience with China, and that what will emerge will not be, you know, exactly the same or even similar to our institutions, and that we shouldn't expect it to be. It is clear that there is a strong commitment on the part of the central government to comply with the transparency and administrative requirements of the WTO. And these reforms will benefit foreign businesses, but also they'll benefit Chinese entrepreneurs and enterprises as well. But the real area where reform is needed is in the area of the judiciary. Changes are occurring, but there are some serious impediments to progress. And the WTO obligations really do not address many of the systemic problems. For businesses, there remains a long road ahead for China in the march toward a functioning rule of law, free of corruption and political influence, which can guarantee private rights and resolve disputes effectively. Thank you very much.
I mean, there may be specific constituencies, but I can't imagine if any other agreement that would have such far-reaching impact internally than the WTO obligations. So now I would like to ask Andrew, would you like to stand up? Or? And then we'll have questions and discussion.
Well, first of all, let me add my thanks to Professor Alai for the invitation, and also for WCL more generally for really extraordinary hospitality. And I'll also add my congratulations to many others for the success of the ILSP program. I think that my paper, which is a more general commentary and perhaps a bit more theoretical commentary on the transparency obligations, dovetails well with Professor Steger's. So as Kanade mentioned, we've been asked to turn our attention to what are really a relatively under-researched set of obligations in the WTO. So obligations which set out the ways in which WTO members are required to administer their laws rather than imposing substantive constraints on the laws themselves. So obligations about impartiality, procedural fairness, objectivity, transparency, and so on. And we've been asked to consider what the effects of these obligations have been or might be on the domestic administration of laws, and a very interesting set of questions were posed about the ways in which these provisions might be implicitly promoting a vision of a Western post-industrial regulatory state. Now, I said that these are relatively under-researched provisions, and WTO lawyers probably have not paid enough attention to these transparency provisions. And it's also true that, by and large, we don't produce a lot of socio-legal research. So one consequence of that is that it's actually impossible as an empirical matter to answer the question, what impact have these provisions had on the domestic administration of laws? Simply because in most countries, perhaps China is an exception, no one's actually carried out that investigation. No one has gone and talked to the relevant government officials, asked about the extent to which they're aware of WTO transparency obligations, how far those obligations influence what they do and in what ways, and whether they've made any changes in their actual regulatory decision-making practices in response to them. So I suppose my first comment is that it's very useful to ask these questions because that kind of socio-legal research is needed, not just in relation to transparency obligations, but I think more generally in relation to WTO obligations. But what we can do is speculate on what the future effect or even the current effect of these provisions might be, both now and in the future. So as we've heard, the transparency obligations contained in the GATT, in the GATS, in the SBS, the TBT, the SCM agreement, and so on, they include provisions such as an obligation to publish all relevant regulations promptly, to notify affected parties in advance to enable them to adjust their activities in good time, and also these notice and comment procedures that we've talked about. And in addition to providing what have been called national inquiry points for questions from other WTO members about proposed and current regulations. Now, I was expecting Professor Thomas to talk a little bit about the benefits of these provisions because I wanted to have some sceptical comments on the side. But let me just quickly summarise what the benefits might be. So I think that these transparency obligations facilitate the participation of more of the actors which are affected by regulation. So facilitation of more participation in the policy-making process. So it's obviously an axiom of democratic governance that those actors which are affected by regulation ought to have some form of input into the lawmaking process. And it's also an axiom, I suppose, of current understandings of global governance that decisions made in one country affect foreign actors. And so there is a gap here. How do we incorporate the input of foreign actors affected by the regulations in one country into the regulatory decision-making process. And these transparency mechanisms are part of a mechanism to deal with that accountability gap. Second, I think they help to raise the quality of policy debate by making sure that those debates are based on more timely and more accurate information. I don't think we should underestimate that benefit. Thirdly, I think by providing notification in advance, by providing for opportunities for consultation, these kind of procedures can help to identify problems before they arise, so enabling the avoidance of problems rather than dealing with them in a post hoc manner. And in fact, the panel yesterday on the pulp mills dispute was a classic example of this. One of the panelists mentioned that if Uruguay and Argentina had got together before the decisions had been made, discussed the potential problems not only as between themselves but also with the local communities, quite possibly those issues would not have arisen. And as I say, I think these transparency obligations within the WTO are designed to facilitate precisely that kind of dialogue in the trade policy context. And fourthly, I think that transparency mechanisms help to begin processes of dialogue which improve policymaking through the sharing of experience and sharing of expertise and sharing of knowledge. So I think they're the four key mechanisms by which transparency improves the quality of regulation. And I do think that those benefits are real, and in fact I've written on this elsewhere, but instead of making that case, I just wanted to sound four notes of caution and scepticism before moving on to something else quite briefly at the end. So the first note of caution or scepticism is that I think we need to be realistic about the extent to which writing procedural or transparency obligations into WTO will actually translate into changed legal practice on the ground. And Professor Steger has already mentioned this in the context of China. So more generally, I suspect that most governmental officials, particularly in developed countries, currently know little, if anything, about these provisions. And to the extent that they do know about them, I suspect that many assume, and maybe rightly, that standard practices are sufficient to comply with them in all but the rarest of cases. Furthermore, I wonder whether writing them into WTO agreements and having them enforceable through the WTO dispute settlement understanding is actually the best mechanism to ensure compliance with them. The costs of WTO dispute settlement procedures are high. The remedies for breach of procedural obligations will often not be commercially meaningful for exporters. And so very often, not always, but very often, there will be a little incentive other than for major repeat players to bring claims based purely on a violation of transparency obligations. So even if we agree that the kinds of behaviour envisaged by transparency obligations is potentially beneficial, I think there's a real question as to whether trying to encourage and enforce such behaviour through binding WTO legal obligations is the most effective way of achieving that. Second note is that since transparency obligations work to increase the quality of regulation through the mechanisms of policy dialogue, information sharing, and so on, I think they're unlikely to be effective in disciplining cases of deliberate and considered regulatory protectionism. If a government is determined to enact trade restrictive regulation, all the transparency in the world is not going to make a difference. In such cases, transparency, and by that I mean something more general, like providing elaborate procedures to justify what we might call a preordained result, seems much more about legitimation of the result than it does about anything else. The third note of caution is that in order to make the case that WTO transparency obligations will make a positive difference in the way that laws are made and administered, we have to show that the kinds of information that they make available and the forms of participation and comment that they make available are better than those which are already available to key members. In other words, does an exporting firm or its government learn anything new by being notified through the WTO of a proposed measure, learn anything new which they could not have learned through specialist newsletters, through personal contacts, and so on? Are the opportunities for comment better than the access that firms can already have through more informal lobbying means and personal relationships and so on? And again, of course, sometimes the answer will be yes. My point is simply a qualification to say that many times the answer will be no. One can imagine that major exporters from perhaps developed countries may have already developed informal mechanisms to facilitate participation and information gathering to some extent. And the fourth is that there's a real case to be made that the transparency provisions of the WTO may actually in some cases decrease rather than increase the accountability of decision making. Why? Well, some of these transparency obligations work through the WTO, not necessarily at the national level. That is, information is provided about trade barriers to the WTO Secretariat, which then disseminates it to all WTO members, which then facilitates informal or semi-formal discussions about those regulations within the WTO itself. So one is left wondering whether in some cases, the real effect of these transparency obligations is not necessarily to open up national decision making to more actors, but rather to shift the locus of some decision making to venues which are actually less transparent, less accountable, and less participatory than domestic ones. That's a serious concern, one which is often raised by many people in the context of particularly global administrative law approaches to international institutions. But in the last few minutes, let me leave those notes of concern or qualification, I suppose, to one side and draw attention to something quite different, which is perhaps a little bit more theoretical, a little bit more under the radar, but I think is very important. So I said before that many of the transparency obligations in the GATT, the GATS, the SPS, the TBT, and so on, require members to notify the WTO or the relevant WTO committee of any new regulations or regulatory changes which may significantly affect trade. Some of those procedures are working well, some are working less well. So, for example, both the TBT and the SPS committee have received many hundreds of notifications and have produced quite a comprehensive is not the word, but quite a significant database of these measures. The Council for Trade in Services, which receives notifications in relation to trade in services barriers, are not going so well. They receive maybe a handful each year. And in fact, most of those notifications are about countries saying, look, we've reduced barriers to trade. So they don't have much of a database of the barriers to trade. And in addition, there's something called the Trade Policy Review Mechanism, which performs a very similar transparency function through kind of top-down processes. So the Trade Policy Review Mechanism is a process by which all WTO members are periodically subject to review by their peers. They submit a report every 6, 8, 10, 4, sometimes years, outlining all aspects of all relevant aspects of their domestic policy environment. The Secretariat provides another report, and a discussion occurs between all members who turn up on the basis of those reports. So through those bottom-up and top-down transparency provisions, the point that I wanted to make is that the WTO is helping to build a map of the nature and extent of trade barriers around the world. And the simple point I wanted to make is that this mapping process is, in my view, one of the most important things that the WTO does. Maybe I should, the most underemphasized thing that the WTO does. So let me just make three brief points about that mapping process and why I think it's important. One, these maps or the information that the WTO produces are highly influential and highly authoritative. There's a huge effort, for example, underway by a lot of economists and statisticians to map not only trade in services, but barriers to trade in services. This has never really been done, partly because the concept of trade in services didn't really arise until the 1970s. There's not really an agreed methodology of defining a barrier to trade in services, or really a lot of statistical work being done to produce data on them. And so what these body of experts are doing is drawing very heavily on the information generated by WTO processes, generated through trade policy review mechanism reports, generated in the SBS, the GATS, the TBT committees, and also generated in GATS schedules themselves. We can talk about that later if you want. So in other words, the first point is that WTO produced information on the nature and extent of trade barriers is being treated by policymakers as among the best and most authoritative information we have. The second point, which is perhaps a little more theoretical, is that mapping is an active exercise, not just an exercise in discovering what is out there. So it involves choices and active selection of information, of what information to include on a map, choices about what kinds of governmental measures to count as trade barriers, which is not always a self-evident and obvious choice, which measures to focus on in a country, how to weight different kinds of barriers for comparative purposes. And also the maps which are produced are in some sense socially embedded. In other words, they depend in part on who turns up at a TPRM meeting, on what their strategic priorities are, and who submits what kinds of information to these committees. And the third, final point is that the information created by these transparency procedures influence policy outcomes very strongly, in my view. Policymakers necessarily use pictures of what trade barriers are out there to evaluate market access opportunities, to define interests and inform priorities and strategies in trade negotiations, to support the comparison of reciprocal commitments in such negotiations, to facilitate an assessment of the desirability of assessments of decisions made in the past, and also to provide a statistical and factual background for the settling of disputes, among many others. And in fact, there's a very influential and important set of figures at the World Bank currently publishing a great deal and influencing in subtle but important ways to the agenda of developing countries in relation to negotiations on trade and services. And it's very clear when you read this work that there is that these people are drawing on the data provided in the WTO for their maps of what trade barriers are out there. I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing. I'm simply drawing I'm simply drawing attention to the causal mechanisms underlying this. So I suppose my point there is that the processes by which the WTO produces knowledge about the world, knowledge which then feeds directly back into policy-making processes, are an important way in which the WTO influences policy outcomes, and the WTO transparency obligations influence policy outcomes. I don't think we understand very much about them. I think the transparency obligations are a very major part of them. But let me finish there, and perhaps we can start up discussion on some of those points.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andrew. I mean, I think this worked out well where we started looking at just GATS and the GATS obligations in the services. And Anne asked us the question, are these GATS obligations interfering too much in the regulatory space that we assume that governments will have? Deborah then looked, gave us the story of China. I mean, China's situation is particularly unique, as Andrew pointed out, where you have a country that has a WTO plus obligations in its accession protocol, transparency being a big issue. I mean, here is a government agreeing that they're going to publish in three official languages of the WTO, meaning Spanish, English, and French. And their those are the three languages. I don't think they're official languages of China or anybody in China using it, but those are the three languages that in within 90 days. And this is when I first heard that, I said, this is amazing. I mean, but as Deborah said, this is maybe an industrial revolution. You see, this is a revolution that even though it is not totally fueled by the WTO obligations, definitely WTO obligations are putting a framework by which these things are happening. And I don't think they would have happened in such an organized fashion if we didn't have the WTO obligations. But then Andrew did something very interesting. I mean, this is why I think Andrew and I had this conversation in Bretton Woods, is I think there's not enough emphasis being placed, either by scholars or by people who write about trade, on these transparency obligations in terms of their impact. And mainly because, as Andrew pointed out, if you go look through the WTO dispute settlement cases, which is what we lawyers read, the transparency issues are always secondary. They always talk about the substantive issues, and as I think Andrew pointed out, these are not things that are readily easy for dispute settlement to address. So I was always wondering, what is really their impact? We don't have, as you said, we don't have the sociolegal research. We don't know what the impact has been, except with the exception of China, where maybe we do. And then Andrew's point of looking back in meta, looking at and saying, well, you know, we haven't really looked into how all of this information that the WTO is gathering, this mapping of trade barriers, which is not just substantive, we're talking about procedural, how is all of this affecting policy? Because if this is how this is how governments are looking at their own, I mean, it's a mirror that is sort of this, it's a picture that's drawn by the WTO, which is then affecting domestic governance. So it's all stuff that I don't think comes into play too much when we talk about WTO's effects on laws around the world. So I would like to see if any of the panelists would like to say, Deborah or Andrew, in response, or maybe we should just open it up. If you feel like you wanted to say something, you want to, like, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think Andrew, Professor Lang has made some very important points, and it's absolutely...
Can you hear her?
Can everybody hear? It's absolutely true that, you know, you don't see very often the transparency obligations in the WTO actually coming up in the dispute settlement cases. I'm pretty familiar with the first 60 or 70 cases in the WTO that I happened to be personally involved with when I was working with the appellate body, but... you know, the transparency obligations just aren't raised by parties. So, but one thing that I was thinking is, you know, maybe that's not the only way. We lawyers tend to think, oh, well, dispute settlement is the way that obligations are enforced or administered, but it's not the only way. Andrew's point about the committee and council meetings is really important because every day in the WTO, you know, there are at least sort of 10 meetings taking place, and some delegations have difficulty sending people to them because there's so many meetings taking place. And at each one of those meetings, whether it's the SPS committee or the TBT committee or the Trade and Environment committee, in fact, there's more committees than there are agreements. Domestic legislation, regulations, the TRIPS, you know, Council has reviewed almost every member's patent legislation, it's copyright legislation, you name it. I remember just being surprised at the amount of legislation, regulations, et cetera, and proposed regulations that are reviewed by these committees on a daily basis. It's really quite phenomenal. One of the problems, and again, it's not the developing countries, and certainly not those that, you know, have recently acceded, because they are really doing an incredible job of trying to live up to their transparency obligations. But one of the big problems in the WTO is that the developed countries don't always notify the things that they're supposed to. I know I was interviewed recently by a newspaper in Canada because Government of Canada decided to give another $1 billion, which is small in U.S. terms, but to the agriculture industry in Canada. There's probably an election coming up, so the government decided to give a bunch of money to farmers recently, about a week ago, 2 weeks ago. And I was interviewed about whether that was WTO consistent, and I said, well, it's difficult to tell because Canada hasn't notified any of its agricultural subsidies since 2002, so who knows how much there is left in the amber box or the blue box or whatever box, and it's certainly true that the developed countries do not, you know, if they think that there might be a problem with a particular subsidy program in particular, they won't notify it. And it's pretty hard to sort of find out sometimes. There are a lot of measures. Governments have also become very smart. I mean, again, I'm sorry to say this, and I probably shouldn't say it publicly, but the Canadian government, when it's granting subsidies these days, doesn't put it in laws or in legislation or regulations or in they do it, you know, kind of behind closed doors by an executive act, and then if the case goes to the WTO, as it did in the Canada aircraft cases, they will claim government confidentiality and say, oh, it's secret, we can't share the information with the dispute settlement panel. The government of Canada did that 18 times in the Canada aircraft case, so much so that, you know, the appellate body basically had to say to the panel, why didn't you do something about that? Because the panel ultimately found that Brazil had not met its burden of proof because Canada refused to provide the information. So that's a case where not only did Canada not notify under its obligations in the subsidies agreement to the relevant committee, it also refused to provide the information to the dispute settlement panel when it came up. So anyway, thank you. That was one comment.
All right, go ahead.
My experience matches very much what Deborah said, because when I first heard about the panel, I thought, well, it could be interesting to talk about how the EU or Germany, where I come from, deal with notifications in the WTO. And I thought, that's funny. I worked for 5 years in the trade division, and I went to Brussels twice a week to the trade committee, but notifications has never been an issue. And then I thought, oh, that's, I know, perhaps you just did a bad job. So I just called my colleagues at home again, and I said, so what do we do? How do we deal with notifications for GATS, for DBT, TBT, and within the German government? Nobody knew. I mean, nobody was responsible for that. So I thought, okay, I have a friend in the commission. Perhaps, you know, we have this very specific relationship between member states and the European Commission. So I called him up, and I said, so what do we do in Germany? Do we notify, or... He said, no, actually, you don't do. I mean, like, it's a non-issue. And I looked at the website, and I found that in the past 5 years, Germany and Sweden have made 3 TBT notifications. And so I decided, okay, I shouldn't talk about notification in the context of the EU anymore, but I think it just shows that even we in the EU have such a big problem with that, and it's a non-issue. So it was quite an interesting experience to find out. Yeah.
So I would like to open it up now about anything the panel has said, also any other questions you may have about transparency obligations, WTO, if you would come up and speak in the mic. Thanks.
Hi, I was wondering if you saw a paradox between transparency obligations and non-violation complaints, and whether that might be a reason why countries wouldn't want to admit to legislation that might distort the trade. Is that an issue at all?
Transparency and non-violation claims.
Well, I can try to answer that. I mean, I don't think there's a direct relation between that, because, you know, don't forget, I mean, well, 99% of cases in the WTO are violation claims, so that they're simply a claim that a rule has been breached, and what we're talking about are notifications and, you know, information being provided about the government measure itself, right, and whether or not it exists and what the contents of that measure are. It's really evidence that's critical in any dispute settlement case. Non-violation claims relate to claims that even if a government has not violated a particular rule, it has somehow, you know, otherwise nullified or impaired benefits. And usually that relates to, in the past, is related to, you know, new subsidies that have been granted that have modified expectations arising from a recent tariff concession. So I fail to see sort of the link, because really what you're talking about in the transparency side is, you know, providing other governments with information about what your measures are, and non-violation claims are a different sort of legal cause of action that you can have dispute settlement about. So I don't know.
Yeah, I suppose. Missing something. No, I think I would just echo those comments. Non-violation complaints are tremendously rare and becoming rarer and rarer. There's not been a single non-violation complaint which has actually been successful. And, I mean, with the judicialization of the WTO in 1994, they're becoming, to some extent, they're a reflection and relic of the kinds of dispute settlement and the kinds of rule enforcement which was characteristic of the GATT and less so of the WTO. So I think that, I mean, my sense is, and, you know, you're much more aware of this than I am, Professor Steger, but my sense is that they are becoming less and less of a concern for countries, and so that possibility of raising a non-violation complaint would not be very high in the minds of governments in terms of their decision whether or not to notify. I think just more generally, the decision whether or not to notify is based partly on whether or not they want to draw attention to a measure, and there's never very much incentive for countries to want to draw attention to their own barriers. And more generally, this sense, I think, an almost complacent sense that transparency provisions are about them and not us. You know, our governance mechanisms are fine. You know.
That seems to be the pattern. Right, it's about them.
Actually, there is one point on non-violation claims, you know, because, I mean, there have been two or three cases where they were raised in since 95. But one of the most important cases was the Japan film case, and the claim wasn't ultimately successful. But the reason it failed was because the United States failed to provide enough evidence about exactly.
This is the Fuji Kodak case.
Sorry?
The Fuji Kodak case.
Yeah. Exactly, you know, what the impact of the measure was on the tariff concessions that had been made, frankly, a long, long, long time ago. And it was unable to demonstrate that its benefits had been nullified or impaired. And it was an evidentiary problem. But, you know, that's another problem in WTO dispute settlement. It's very important, and I guess it makes the transparency obligations all the more important in any case, and that is that the burden of proof lies with the complaining party, but the evidence about the government measure lies with the responding party. And if the responding party, there's no discovery process in the WTO, so if the responding party refuses to provide information about its measures, it can be very, very difficult, not only for developing countries, but for anybody, any country, to try to meet the burden of proof and to actually prove, first of all, that the measure exists, secondly, exactly how it works, because, you know, how a measure actually works in practice is critical to determining whether or not it's consistent or inconsistent with WTO obligations. And this is a huge problem, and I think particularly in subsidy cases, which is why I raised the Brazil and Canada aircraft disputes, but there have been other subsidy cases where, you know, panels have been unable to make legal findings and conclusions because they didn't have the evidence in front of them, and because, you know, the responding party, obviously it wasn't in the responding party's interest to provide it. On the other hand, the appellate body said something very important in the first Brazil or the first Canada aircraft appeal, and that is panels should not be shy about drawing adverse inferences when the responding party absolutely, fails and repeatedly refuses to provide the evidence that it's being asked to provide. There have been a handful, two or three cases, where panels have drawn adverse inferences and found violations on that basis. This is another problem in the trade remedy cases. You know, anti-dumping, countervail safeguards, again, if the investigating authority doesn't want to provide all of the record before it, and it might claim business confidential, you know, reasons or whatever. Governments are good at coming up with all kinds of confidentiality rules. But it's very difficult for an international tribunal to obtain, you know, that information sometimes.
Any other questions?
I don't know the transparency obligation.
Yes, come. Nora and then you can come up if you want. Yeah. Quick question. Is that on? Just shout it.
Okay. You mentioned that parties usually do not raise the issue of transparency. Can you tell us what? Which do you think that might be the reasons? Is it in what way, or why do you think they don't raise that issue. That's the full question. Because I'm just thinking about proof. I'm a lawyer, but I know that it's not difficult to prove the economic impact of a discriminatory measure or a over-regulation in countries. So you just come up with an argument, so you can just give the panel all the information about the economic impact of an over-regulation. So why do you think the parties do not raise that issue?
Sometimes they raise it in trade remedy cases. You'll see it raised in anti-dumping, countervail safeguards cases, but then they tend to raise the procedural provisions that are in those agreements that are really quite specific and that reflect basic, you know, administrative procedure kind of rules that you have in domestic legal systems. But And panels in the appellate body have indeed, you know, ruled on some of these provisions. The thing is, at the end of the day, I guess, complaining parties don't raise them always, and panels sometimes will, after making other findings, sort of exercise judicial economy with respect to the transparency provisions, because at the end of the day, you know, what's the remedy? You know, if all that the case is going to stand for at the end of the day, or the only violation is a violation of a transparency provision, then you're not going to get, if you're the complaining party. I mean, the complaining party is always very, very concerned and focused on what's the end game? What are we going to get at the end of the day? If all that's been violated is a transparency provision, then what do they have to do? You know, notify it to some committee. Okay, fine, we'll do that tomorrow, and then, you know, there's no violation. So obviously they're going to try to point to other substantive provisions in the agreement that have been violated. Why? Because they probably want the measure or action to be, you know, repealed or replaced with something else. There's probably bigger fish that they like to fry than the transparency obligations. And the same thing with the panel. Once the panel's gone through the substantive obligations and maybe found a major violation of a really important provision that basically makes the measure illegal, then who cares anymore about whether they didn't notify it or publish it properly. It's
I think in 2003 or something, I tried to do a survey of just Article 10, which is a basic. I mean, and it was raised by a handful of cases, but almost every instance, except shrimp turtle, appellate body, where they actually did say there was a violation of Article 10. They said it's not necessary for us to address Article 10 because there already was a violation. So it's not necessary to deal with a transparency question. Yes, sir, the final question.
My question is related to China, the development of Professor Steger. I would like to know if there is any clue to say today that this tremendous evolution in China is impacting in any way China's population. Is there simply two standard evolution, where China's population is marginalized completely, and China is making everything to satisfy international community, or is there any impact on the internal population? I would like to respond to another question myself. Yesterday, we discussed here about the issue of WTO as development organization. I didn't think I got a question. I got an answer. I would like to know if WTO implementation can impact the development of our populations. Thank you.
I know that's a long question to answer, but you can do that. You can have a short answer. One thing, I may just add to that. You said that there were domestic constituencies in China that one was feeling this as well. So let me, as part of that question, say, maybe you can expand, who are those domestic constituencies? Because I think what you mean is the population at large. Who is it that's being actually who is fueling this changes, legal changes?
Well, I think in China, and you know, you have to forgive me because I'm not a China expert, but I'm very interested in trying to follow as much as I can from the reading. What is happening is largely being driven by the central government. I think that's clear. And the regional and local governments are not moving along, certainly at the same pace or on the same scale. But the transparency moves that China has made do affect Chinese enterprises, stakeholders, and public, as well as foreign enterprises. In fact, foreign enterprises don't always have the same rights as Chinese enterprises, although it's true that for some recent laws that the National People's Congress has passed, it has allowed comment from foreign enterprises. I think the comment that they have been seeking from Chinese enterprises and individuals has actually been broader. But there's absolutely no question that really a lot of the real regulation in China is not, you know, conducted by the national central government at all, although it has sort of the supreme authority. It's really conducted by the local and regional governments. And on that front, you know, there's a totally different sort of dynamic happening. And I think we're going to see, and we've seen already, you know, considerable unrest in parts of China. And I think we are seeing, you know, the public responding and really driving change, wanting change. And driving change. People have access to the internet, and you know, they know what it's like in the rest of the world, and they're very, very anxious for change. So I have a lot of faith in the Chinese people, not so much in the Chinese government or governments, plural. But I think ultimately there will be a kind of a people's movement, and things will change even more in China because it'll be driven by the public. That's sort of my feeling or my impression. In terms of, is the WTO a development organization? I gave a talk, and then I came to hear that panel, and I gave a talk at lunch yesterday at another law school.
We won't name it. Yeah, Georgetown. We can say it.
And then I came to hear the last part of that panel on, is the WTO a development organization? And I said at the other luncheon meeting yesterday that the mandate of the WTO, the purpose of the WTO, is very unclear these days. And that is, I think, one of the problems that in the Doha round, it's caused the paralysis in the Doha round. And I think, quite frankly, that the developed countries in the WTO are going to have to wake up very soon and recognize that development is one of the purposes, one of the mandates of the WTO. It's there in the preamble. It was there in the preamble of the GATT.
I mentioned that yesterday. Nobody else
the
wanted to follow
up. The overwhelming majority of WTO members, you know, 80% are developing countries. How can you say that development is not a purpose in the WTO? It is. But reconciling that with the developed countries, including my country, that insist that the WTO is about nothing more than accelerating the process of trade liberalization, staying on that bicycle, it is very difficult because of the entrenched views of the developed countries. But, you know, there's something else in the preamble of the WTO as well. It, thanks to the United States, it also talks about sustainable development and about the environmental dimension. So I've been calling in some of the writings and speeches that I've been making for a time out in the WTO, for people to spend some time really thinking and debating and discussing what the purposes of the WTO are, so that there can be sort of a collective understanding. In my mind, that is the fundamental reason why the Doha round has failed, because there are just completely different perceptions about what the organization is supposed to be doing.
And I suspect that the person you had dinner with last night, Jim Baucus, disagrees with you on this one.
Oh, well, we didn't talk about that, so.
Okay. Any short comment here?
Yeah, I just had a couple of very quick comments in relation to that question about development institution and your earlier question. One way of answering the question, is the WTO, well, let me give me two comments in relation to WTO, is the WTO a development institution? One is that, you know, the mandate and the purpose, this collective sense of purpose in the WTO has evolved tremendously over the past 50 years, and we're just in a period where we're rethinking and renewing that. So it's not a question of returning to the documents, returning to an original conception. We're just in a process of change, and it's a question for us to decide now what we want the purpose to be, not to return to what we think it is. The second way of answering that question is the WTO a development institution? Well, it affects development. What it does affects development. And so we can reframe that question as, do we want the WTO to pay attention to the effects that it has on development? You know, and when you reframe it that way, it strikes me the answer must be yes.
Sure.
Just in relation to the reasons that parties have for not raising transparency obligations, I think Professor Steger answered that perfectly. In a particular individual dispute, you know, the remedies, the obvious answer is, what remedies do you get? One qualification to that would be that one can easily imagine a case being brought to try and produce systemic change in a country's regulatory structure, maybe China. You know, you can imagine a country which has many major exporters engaged with a country, and which wants to, which is a major repeat player, which is what I was trying to suggest in my talk.
I think Fuji Kodak was an attempt at that.
Right, exactly. Yeah, classic.
Unsuccessful.
Yeah, classic, yeah, unsuccessful. But there, you can expect, I think, transparency obligations to be raised, even in their own right, not just as throwing in as many different violations as you can find.
I want to thank you all for attending. I know that the LLM board maybe has something they would like to say, or some gifts they would like to give to the panelists. No, those are not ours. They're ours. Okay. But I do want to thank you all for coming. I just want to make a housekeeping announcement. I want to thank the panelists so much for coming and being here with us. There's a next panelist coming up. For those of you that are in my international trade class, we do have a makeup class starting at 4:30 in room 101. And we'll have a guest panelist, too. Thank you.
No, we're supposed to be here.